Good evening, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Rounds with the Investigators. As tonight, our esteemed faculty will be presenting cases involving the management of HER2-low and ultra-low breast cancer. We have an outstanding faculty tonight as a part one of our three-part series here in this room here in San Antonio, Dr. Antonio Wolf from the Johns Hopkins University, Dr. Aditya Bardia from UCLA Health Johnson Comprehensive Cancer Center, Professor Giuseppe Sirigliano from the University of Milano and the European Institute of Oncology, and Dr. Hope Rugo from the University of California, San Francisco, and the Helen Diller Family Comprehensive Cancer Center. Here are the disclosures for the faculty. They're also present on your iPads and in the chat room for the people online. Just to mention that we will be talking tonight about the use of non-FDA-approved agents, so consult the appropriate package inserts for more information. So let's dig in here tonight, and we have four modules. We're going to start out with Antonio, who's going to, this is like the Talmudic Academy of HER2 to try to go through the history of this, but what an incredible history it's been with this biomarker that we finally got to the point where it's now we're talking tonight about HER2-low and ultra-low. Really amazing to think about. Then Aditya, who just came back from the session presenting data, which we're going to actually take a look at from the DESTINY-Breast06 study. And then Professor Sirigliano is going to talk about some of the practical issues, particularly related to tolerability, particularly of trastuzumab deruxtecan, which obviously is a key issue here with HER2-low. And finally, Hope will finish up with the really wild new things going on. And her slide deck is really full of really great new stuff and even a couple of new approvals for us to be thinking about. But just to mention, too, we have three posters here at the San Antonio meeting. We like to survey people, so we have a few posters. A couple times, I think, during the meeting here tonight and the next three nights, I'll be bringing up some of the things we saw in these surveys. So Antonio, why don't you take it away and help us understand the biology and clinical utilization of a HER2, particularly as it relates to HER2-low and ultra-low.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be with all of you. This is complicated, but it's not meant to be complicated. And actually, I think it's becoming a lot simpler. So the topic, optimizing identification of HER2-low and HER2-ultra-low in breast cancer, goes back to why did ASCO and the College of American Pathologists decide to join forces in 2005. In the past, these types of assays, they were adjuncts to anatomic pathology, and so many labs would develop their own assays, modify them as needed, and it was not until HER2 became a predictive biomarker as the single determinant of therapy selection that the test accuracy became a must. And so just being done in a CLIA certified lab was not enough. We needed to worry about issues of analytic validity and also clinical validity. And this is so important for HER2-low and ultra-low in the sense, are they defined clinical entities? And the issue I can tell you right now, I suspect that from what we know, they may not be. The challenge when you have a targeted agent in a companion diagnostic test means the potential for a big mess, and I think we're all learning how to deal with that. Many of you may remember when we began to do the first generation of adjuvant trials, the determination of HER2-positive disease was being done locally. And there was a huge amount of false positive test results, both with immunohistochemistry and as well as fluorescent in situ hybridization. Despite the initial call out, we needed to be more careful throughout the duration of the trial, the continuation of major false positive results, and there was a change in the middle of the study to mandate centralized testing. A lot of discordance between local and central labs. What we keep forgetting about HER2, you can read what HER2 is, a glycoprotein transmembrane TK tyrosine kinase. This is the key piece. Normal tissues do express HER2 protein and mRNA without amplification. Tissues throughout the body, epithelial tissues, will have evidence of HER2 at some level. And below is one of the examples of monoclonal antibodies that was initially developed because of its characteristics to tested and developed in tumors that were really amplified. That is the antibody that is being used now where you have normal levels of expression. So the rationale for the ASCO CAP effort, trastuzumab was now a real drug in metastatic disease. There was a need for a commercial test to be available in the clinic. Very poor concordance, as we discussed. 2005, trastuzumab became approved as an adjuvant therapy. This is no longer about palliation. It is about the difference between the potential of cure versus not. So HER2 testing, a determinant of therapy selection. Three generations of ASCO CAP guidelines. The first time worried about false positives. The second edition, 2013, a little bit more worried about the issue of false negatives. And in 2018, specifically looking at individual patterns of expression that needed the attention of the clinician and the pathologist. With the HER2 guidelines and then with the ASCO CAP ER guidelines, there was a major ramping up of proficiency in testing across the U.S. Most labs now participating in proficiency in testing. And as a result, the quality of HER2 and ER testing has improved. This is what was discussed mainly in 2018, unusual patterns, micropapillary patterns, apocrine patterns, concerns about crush, artifact, and keep in mind the biology matter. If you have a grade 1 tumor with a favorable histologic subtype, it's very unlikely that this is going to be HER2 3+, so be careful if you get a result like that. And you can start seeing on the left side of the slides on top, the challenges when you move into low levels of expression, it becomes very difficult for the naked eye and perhaps even digital pathology to truly understand and differentiate. So the bigger picture was to improve the analytic validity of HER2 testing. We were then dealing with tumors that were HER2 addicted, HER2 overexpressed, HER2 gene amplify. That remains the primary predictor of responsiveness to HER2 targeted therapy. And then, of course, the rest is history. 2019, 5 years ago, TDXD, trastuzumab deruxtecan, becomes a real drug. And we need to go back and try to understand, do HER2 antibodies work if the HER2 is negative? This is back to the NSABP B31. There was a secondary unplanned analysis suggesting that maybe it would work in so-called HER2 normal or HER2 negative, not amplified, not overexpressed. This led to the NSABP B47. And as you know, the story, trastuzumab does not work in tumors that are not HER2 addicted. This is the first, one of the first studies, a phase 1b of trastuzumab deruxtecan, and we begin to see in the plots that you see that there is clearly a high level of activity in tumors that are HER2 addicted, amplified, overexpressed, but in tumors that lack amplification, overexpression, that were called HER2 2+, not amplified, 1+, or 0. Or 1+ in this case, there was actually evidence of activity less than what you would see in a tumor that was HER2 addicted. And the idea here is that there is drug delivery to a target, but this is not necessarily part of the biology of that tumor. That tumor does not depend on HER2. DESTINY-Breast04 was presented, was published. The FDA extended the label. The FDA extended the label of the antibody now to be used for that potential indication. The implications were huge. The immediate question was, what about the HER2 guidelines? Do they need to change? And I think the big question is, is there something called HER2 low, HER2 ultra low? I think that there's a major concern that if the localizing target for drug delivery is the HER2 protein, HER2 low detected by IHC may clinically behave no different than HER2 zero. And that is because every breast tumor has HER2, and HER2 IHC0 may be a fixation artifact and not real biology. And so the question becomes, what exactly is the meaning and the reason for these terminologies? The DAISY trial actually showing in cohort 3 is a population of patients that were IHC0, and you can see numerically no difference in the activity when you have a tumor that is called IHC0 versus a tumor that is called IHC1+. And so this HER2 low implies actually these are simply HER2 normal levels. These are tumors that are not positive for amplification or overexpression. This is long to read. You can read faster than I can. The data did not seem to support a new IHC0 versus 1+ prognostic or predictive threshold. And therefore, the ASCO-CAP panel felt that there was insufficient data to create new categories that were not identifying biologic entities. And then going back to what I mentioned before, IHC0 were not tested in these trials. The same antibody now got a label to potentially allow 1+ to be measured. This became a nightmare for the pathologists. A lot of this could have been simplified if the clinical trials had allowed patients with IHC0 to be enrolled. We do not have evidence to suggest that an IHC0 behaves clinically different, and the evidence may suggest that these tumors will equally respond. In clinical practice, we're going to discuss this, what to do, which tumors to test. Tumors may change. We don't know if biologically they are changing or this is simply an issue of testing and variability. On the left side is IHC1+, in the middle, and on the right side is IHC0. With some staining, they were eligible for DESTINY-Breast06. On the right side, no staining, they were not eligible. This is a slide that Giuseppe Corigliano presented at ASCO a couple of months ago. HER2 ultra-low, a small number of patients that in reality were IHC0 with some staining were eligible for the study and were entered. And if you look at the 2018 ASCO CAP HER2 testing, actually the definitions were there. We did not need a new terminology. The pathologist had the ability to attempt to differentiate HER2 IHC0 some staining versus no staining. The problem is IHC no staining were not included. So what to make of these data? This gets a little bit confusing. We do not today have evidence to create new categories because it is possible that if HER2 zero, no staining had been tested, we would see the same level of activity. So there's a potential that at the end of the day, this could become an exercise of futility. And so what CAP is going to do is simply remind pathologists, use the ASCO CAP figure 1 from 2018 and call something IHC0 some staining. Yes, they will get a label indication, will be able to be treated with the drug. IHC0 no staining. Unfortunately, there's nothing we can do because they were not part of a clinical trial. Here is simply showing the significant variability across pathologies when you move into low levels of staining. And I think we can only wonder, number one, will the trial sponsors make these specimens available so that we can develop and test truly quantitative assays that are not just IHC, but other assays that can truly look at true levels, and we can test the differential benefit according to levels versus not. And for now, we can only imagine how much simpler things would have been if the companies, if the investigators had allowed all patients, including IHC no staining, to participate in these clinical trials, even if in an exploratory manner, as took place in DB06, where they allow some patients IHC0, some staining, for an exploratory analysis. I'll stop here.
Thanks so much, Antonio. And We call this rounds with the investigators. Looks like you got a couple more slides here. Anything you want to say about them?
See, the only thing I could say is that there are attempts in terms of trying to develop new methodologies. We don't have blood assays. There is an aqua immunofluorescence assay that is a lot more sensitive to measure low levels of HER2 in tissue. And these assays are beginning to be tested. And in fact, in the TBCRCO66 study that is beginning now, we're going to try to attempt an association between differential levels of HER2 by aqua immunofluorescence with clinical response. So one of the questions is, what else can we do today? Unfortunately, we do not have other assays beyond immunohistochemistry.
So as I mentioned, we are going to try to sort of make rounds here. We asked the faculty to put together some cases, either cases the patients they're taking care of or modifications of cases they've taken care of or board-like questions they came up with. And we're going to start with a case put together from Giuseppe. I'll just mention, too, that Michael sitting here in the audience must have stopped by Starbucks on the way here because he's already submitted 8 questions. I hope I can get through these. They're really good questions, too. I hope we get through them all. But Giuseppe, this scenario here is an ER-positive patient, gets started out with metastatic disease with abemaciclib fulvestrant, goes on to, I guess, a PIK3 inhibitor that's no longer available, didn't respond to that, and then was found to be HER2 ultra-low, originally HER2 zero, and responds to T-DXd. So I guess one question in my mind, I think everybody's mind, and you put together a slide addressing it, is how reproducible is particularly HER2 low and ultra low. Any comments on some of these data that you presented at ESMO?
Yes, I would like to specify to Antonio that in the DESTINY-6, local pathologies were not asked to differentiate between HER2 low and ultra low. All HER2 zero, according to ASCO-CAP, were eligible. So this was the main question. When locally tested, so patients have been referred as HER2 zero, and then when centrally evaluated by central pathologists, you can see over here that 35% were immunohistochemical zero, 40% were HER2 ultra low, and 24% HER2 low. So even if we ask it to the pathologist to score HER2, they just reported zero. So no one specified that 24% were 1+ and 2+ FISH non-amplified. I was not asking, of course, to identify ultra-low, but as you correctly stated in the ASCO-CAP, HER2 ultra-low is defined as any staining more than 0% and less than 10%. So personally, I believe this is the example on how we should report in the ASCO-CAP correctly how many stained cells are present. So we are not asking to define ultra-low, just to report which staining is present on the slide.
So without trying to get too far ahead of things, just to kind of get back to the practical, Aditya, this is a situation whereby repeat testing, a patient was picked up to be ultra-low. Can you talk about sort of your philosophy about repeat HER2 testing, liquid versus tissue? How aggressive are you? Once you establish HER2 positivity, do you continue HER2 retesting?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think things have changed with T-DXd because it's something that's actionable. And there was an abstract presented at ASCO a couple of years ago that you biopsy enough, you'll find something that's HER2 low. I think in part it speaks to the variability in expression of HER2 when it's present at very low levels. So as Antonio mentioned, HER2 is even present in HER2 IHC 0. It's just that by IHC you cannot detect it. So my personal philosophy is, if it's HER2 low, use T-DXd. If it's HER2 IHC 0, at this time, T-DXd is not approved, but if the FDA were to approve it, then that would be another subgroup where T-DXd can be used.
Hope, how often do you find somebody you just say, this is HER2 zero, I am not using T-DXd?
It's primarily the patients who have triple negative, basal-like, rapidly progressive disease, and they are really zero. And we've been, since DB06 press release, we've been talking to our pathologists and saying, are there any cells out there that look like they have a little HER2? Kind of like Antonio was commenting on. And, so we get this sort of 0 to 1+, report. But the true basal rapidly progressive disease doesn't. And I've had a couple of really bad hormone receptor positive tumors, you know, young patients, bad disease, liver full of tumor, short responses to everything. They're really zero, and you keep repeating it, it keeps being zero. So it's not frequent. You know, I think estimated by just another Giuseppe Viale to be about 15%. And of all of the breast cancer patients we see, I think we also don't really know about the loss of HER2 expression over time as tumors lose ER and become more and more aggressive and how that impacts. Because in DB04, you could have been positive 5 years ago and you were still going to go on study and seem to respond. So
Giuseppe, we met right after you presented the Destiny Breast 06 trial at ASCO, and one of the things you were talking about is your perception in terms of efficacy of T-DXd specifically across the continuum from HER2 ultra low to HER2 positive. What's your take in terms of the chance of response and the quality of response?
So this is an excellent question, because in the clinical trial we demonstrated that the overall response rate in the intent-to-treat population, I mean HER2-low and ultra-low, is close to 57%, but in the HER2-ultra-low, it was 61% versus 30% in the chemotherapy arm. So trastuzumab deruxtecan, compared to chemotherapy, is much more active in terms of response rate. And today, Aditya Bardia showed in the mini-oral presentation that in patients relapsing within 6 months after starting CDK4/6 inhibitors in the metastatic setting, response rate increased close to 70%. So it's a very active agent, much more active than chemotherapy.
So Antonio, Aditya put together sort of this board-like scenario of a 55-year-old postmenopausal woman. He wants to know how you think about sequencing in a patient with hormone receptor positive disease, IHC purely zero, ultra low, low, and I guess high. That would be pretty straightforward. But what's your approach based on if you really decide this is IHC zero? What's your likely therapy after you've given hormonal therapy and capecitabine? And then how do you start thinking about T-DXd as you see ultra low and low?
Absolutely. So I think this is actually what I tend to do in the clinic when I usually transition from endocrine therapy to chemotherapy. If the patient has minimal symptoms, good performance status, I usually go with first-line capecitabine. And then after progression, I think we have various options today. I think it is very legitimate to move in the second-line chemo in this setting to an antibody-drug conjugate. Trastuzumab deruxtecan is a perfect example of something that should be used, can be used, and I often use in the second line before moving to more traditional chemotherapies. We have, in the past, we would do single sequential, single agent, multiple chemotherapy drugs. I think the antibody-drug conjugates have moved very quickly into the second line setting.
So, Aditya, what about ER-negative HER2 ultra-low?
We don't have any data of T-DXd yet in HER2-IHC0 triple-negative breast cancer. Destiny Breast 15 is looking at that question. In triple-negative, I generally then use sacituzumab govitecan.
All right, so we're going to move on and actually let Aditya talk about these exciting data that he just updated a few minutes ago.
That's great. So I'll review available data with HER2-targeted therapies in HER2-low and ultra-low disease. So this was mentioned previously, HER2 ultra-low essentially refers to tumor that have some expression of HER2 detectable by IHC, so that's then less than 10% of tumor cells. And the reason we have this is because of T-DXd. Three features of T-DXd, it's trastuzumab, but the difference is the linker as compared to T-DM1 and the high drug-to-antibody ratio that T-DXd has as compared to T-DM1. And it also has a bystander effect, so it can impact cells that have low or zero expression of HER2. So this is the concept of an ADC. The antibody binds to the target, gets internalized, releases the payload. But an important feature of the newer ADCs include the bystander effect, which can even impact cells with lower expression or no expression. So a couple of years ago, we saw the results of DESTINY-Breast04, which looked at T-DXd versus standard chemotherapy. This was for patients with HER2-low disease. 90% of patients in this trial had hormone receptor-positive breast cancer, 10% hormone receptor-negative, and this trial did require one prior line of chemotherapy in the metastatic setting. The results were very impressive. This was at ASCO plenary, improvement in progression-free survival, overall survival. We saw the updated results at ESMO last year and continued benefit in both in terms of PFS as well as overall survival. So how about lower HER2 expression? I think that was something that was addressed in DESTINY-Breast06. It included patients with HER2 ultra-low disease as well, which was an operational definition of HER2 IHC 0 with some membrane staining, but not high enough to be called HER2-low. The trial randomized patients to T-DXd or standard chemotherapy. Patients could have received two or more prior lines of endocrine-based therapy or just one line of endocrine-based therapy if they had disease progression in 6 months of the first-line therapy or disease progression within 12 months of adjuvant endocrine treatment. The trial did not allow prior chemotherapy, so it was the chemotherapy-naive setting. So these are the important points to note in terms of difference from DESTINY-Breast04. First is the HER2 ultra-low, second, no prior chemotherapy, and third, that patients with rapid disease progression on first-line therapy were eligible for this trial. In terms of baseline characteristics, they were well-balanced between the two arms, including de novo metastatic disease, patients with liver mets. About two-thirds of patients in this clinical trial had liver metastases. So as presented by Professor Coriano at ASCO, there was benefit with T-DXd, median progression-free survival 13.2 months as compared to 8 months with standard chemotherapy, a differential of 5 month improvement in progression-free survival, hazard ratio 0.62. And similar results were seen in HER2 ultra-low as well. Actually, the median PFS was pretty much identical to what was seen in HER2-low with T-DXd. What was interesting to note was the response rate. If there's a differential between HER2 expression and efficacy, we would see higher response rate in, say, HER2-low as compared to HER2 ultra-low. But in this study, the response rate was pretty much identical, if anything, slightly higher in the HER2 ultra-low group as compared to the HER2-low. So T-DXd does have activity even in HER2 ultra-low. And we can continue to discuss, it could be sample, it could be change in expression over time, but at least in this trial, T-DXd had activity in HER2 ultra-low as well, which was very similar to what was seen in the HER2-low setting. Then at San Antonio, we just presented an hour ago the results by time to progression on first-line therapy. As mentioned previously, this trial did allow patients who had rapid disease progression. So if a patient is on CDK4/6 inhibitor plus endocrine therapy and they have disease progression after 4 months or 5 months, after that, patients were eligible for DESTINY-Breast06. And in that subgroup, you could see benefit with T-DXd, median PFS of 14 months versus about 6 months with standard chemotherapy. But it's not that the drug only works in that setting. If we look at 6 to 12 or more than 12, so the other group, there also T-DXd outperforms standard chemotherapy. And if you look at disease burden, this tends to come up in clinic. Now, majority of patients in this trial had visceral metastases. Only a minority had bone metastases. In this clinical trial, if you look at the number of sites, less than 3, more than 3, the benefit with T-DXd was maintained in both these subgroups. So efficacy was also seen in patients with lower disease burden. And again, I'll emphasize, majority of patients in this trial had visceral disease. So patients with bone-only disease was only a minority. The other drug in this setting is sacituzumab govitecan, which targets TROP2. It also has a high drug-to-antibody ratio. The payload is SN38, which is a TOP1 inhibitor, but less potent than deruxtecan. The TROPiCS-02 study, led by Dr. Rugo, showed improvement in both progression-free survival and overall survival with sacituzumab govitecan, median overall survival of 14.5 months with SG versus 11 months with chemo. So clinical question was, would the efficacy vary by HER2 status? Scientifically, the answer was no, because the drug targets TROP2, so the HER2 status should not have an impact, and that was seen in the clinical study as well, both in tumors with HER2 low expression, so that's IHC 1 plus 2 plus, as well as tumors with HER2 IHC 0. The benefit with SG was maintained. So we necessarily don't look at the HER2 status, be it HER2 low versus not, when using SG. And there are other drugs in development as well that target HER2, that target TROP2. In terms of HER2 agents, BBI-1701, disitamab vedotin. Interesting thing about these HER2 agents is that they have a different payload. So trastuzumab deruxtecan has a TOP1 inhibitor as the payload, but these agents have a microtubule inhibitor as the payload. So even if we continue an ADC that's HER2-based and another ADC that's HER2-based, if the resistance is more because of the payload, then these drugs potentially could have efficacy. But they're being evaluated in clinical trials. It's not ready for prime time yet. So it's important to consider not just the target, but also the payload that might impact the efficacy in this advanced setting. So this is my algorithm at this time for management of hormone receptor positive, HER2 negative metastatic breast cancer. In the first line setting, generally recommend endocrine therapy plus a CDK4/6 inhibitor. In the second line setting, strongly recommend genotyping. If a patient has ESR1 mutant disease, elacestrant is an option. For patients with PIK3CA mutation, fulvestrant plus alpelisib or fulvestrant plus capivasertib, also an option if there's P10 mutation or AKT mutation. For patients with germline BRCA mutation, a PARP inhibitor, and patient who does not have actionable alteration, fulvestrant plus minus CDK4/6 or an mTOR inhibitor. And then when we move to chemotherapy, that's where antibody drug conjugates come in. With DB06, you could see superiority of T-DXd over capecitabine as well as over taxanes. But for some patients, chemotherapy such as capecitabine might be preferred before T-DXd. So ultimately needs to be a patient-centered discussion. And then after T-DXd, you have other options, including SG. The only other point to make here is if a patient has rapid disease progression on first-line endocrine therapy plus a CDK4/6 inhibitor, I might move to T-DXd in the second-line setting before other endocrine-based options. So in summary, T-DXd is currently approved for HER2-low metastatic breast cancer, both ER-positive and ER-negative, after one prior line of chemotherapy, but based on DESTINY-Breast06, we see activity in earlier lines as well as HER2 ultra-low MBC. Sacituzumab govitecan is currently recommended for metastatic breast cancer after two prior lines of systemic therapy. And there are a number of other ADCs that are in clinical development, and they'll probably further redefine the current receptor-based classification of breast cancer. That was it.
So we'll let the faculty tomorrow night argue about PIK3 and whether you give alpelisib or capivasertib. And what do you do if both PIK3 and ESR1 are mutated? We'll save that. Come back tomorrow night. We'll hear what the answers to those questions are. But we want to move into a case that Giuseppe has of a patient prior melanoma diagnosis, localized. Actually diagnosed, it looks like, with triple negative disease, gets neoadjuvant therapy, and followed up by radiation and pembro. Interestingly, I noticed here initially that Ki-67 was 60%, 30%. Later on, I think it was elevated also. This is one of Michael's questions. Hope, do you consider Ki-67 in any of these decisions?
I do, actually. I think, you know, in this situation, because we have the I-SPY neoadjuvant program, we get the 70-gene assay called MammaPrint for all of the patients in order for eligibility. So that helps us because it gives us a little bit more information about risk. But I love getting Ki-67. I mean, I think it's really helpful, and it helps us in particularly with HR-positive disease, although we see some discordance sometimes with gene expression assays. I think it's helpful. For triple negative disease, you know, this is a 49-year-old woman. You'd expect her Ki-67 to be high. But, you know, we do occasionally see these patients who have these luminal-like triple negative cancers with Ki-67 of 5%. And so it is helpful to have that and understand the biology. And then the drop in Ki-67 for HR-positive disease has been shown to be very helpful in terms of prognosis, but particularly with endocrine therapy. But for triple-negative disease, we haven't really shown that having two nodes is a bad thing.
So, Giuseppe, you then talk about the fact that this lady, unfortunately, has disease progression. Now, in rebiopsy, she's HER2-low 1+. Incidentally, any difference in your mind? I know that we get into this with the slides, but just to ask you, 1+ versus 2+?
No, personally, no. According to the data of DESTINY-Breast04, even if limited in terms of median PFS, they are exactly overlapping. So in this case, I reassessed again the biology, because in Europe, TDX is approved for early relapse in triple-negative breast cancer. So it was really an opportunity for the patient. And that's why I retested, I discovered that was an HER2-low, and I gave trastuzumab deruxtecan.
So we'll get into that in a second, but actually, Antonio, you have a case also that gets into the issue of sequencing. I'm curious how you think about Giuseppe's case here of triple negative. Interesting about the approval that he just mentioned. Also, a question from Michael and a question that we wanted to talk about, which is if you have multiple sites of metastatic disease, yeah. Any preference about which one you biopsy? Do you sometimes biopsy multiple sites? Where does liquid biopsy fit in?
So I think it depends on what you're trying to accomplish. Obviously, one of the reasons to do a liquid biopsy or a tissue biopsy is also to run NGS assays. And ctDNA probably captures, depending on the assay, about 80% of what you might capture in tumor. And you could argue that you could have different clones in different sites, and ultimately blood may be a better assay because you will ultimately capture a little bit of what's happening everywhere. So I don't have a preference where to biopsy. It's a matter of feasibility. Where is it going to be safe to biopsy? You can re-biopsy looking for mutations. I wouldn't worry too much about the HER2 because I think anything that changes from 1+ to 0, some staining, 0, no staining, at the end of the day, this is more likely to be assay variability that does not have biologic implication. And it is purely because of how the drug was developed. It is a missed opportunity because it could have been so much simpler if all patients that were not HER2 positive have been enrolled in these studies, DESTINY-Breast04-06. We would not be having this conversation. It may not matter. I think so. It could be a lot simpler. If you ask a pathologist, they will be able to identify a little bit of staining somewhere so you can fit FDA label and get the drug approved by the insurance company.
So, Aditya, this is a patient with hormone receptor negative disease. The big question, of course, is how are you going to sequence the ADCs, particularly sacituzumab and TDXD? Here we have HER2 low. You can see the disease. How do you think through a situation like this, Aditya?
I think both are options. One could consider SG or could consider TDXD. If you purely look at the level of evidence, and this was in the ESMO guidelines as well, the level of evidence is higher with SG because the phase 3 ASCENT trial was dedicated for patients with metastatic TNBC. SG was a standard chemo, while DESTINY-Breast04 largely was an ER-positive study. And looking at the ER-negative subset was an exploratory endpoint. It was not a primary or even a secondary endpoint. Having said that, at the end of the day, it's a patient-centered discussion. TDXT is every 3 weeks. SG is day 1, day 8, tends to cause nausea, diarrhea. So you have to have discussion both about evidence but also the AEs and schedule.
So, Giuseppe, I remember we actually did a CME program a couple hours after DESTINY-Breast06 was presented at ASCO a couple years ago. And, of course, everybody's trying to figure out what does this mean. And we heard a lot of people saying what Aditya just said in terms of sacituzumab. And then as time has gone on, I'm not so sure people have always stuck with that. You know, you take the data, but you also take your clinical experiences. In this case, you treated the patient with TDXD. What were you thinking?
Well, you know, we decided for TDXT because there is a specific lab for patients with triple negative disease and the early relapse. This was formerly a first-line treatment in the ancient trial where not included patients in the first line. I agree that there was a level of evidence 1A, but in later lines. So I extrapolated the data from the DESTINY-4, very few patients, and since there was a label, I decided to give trastuzumab deruxtecan to this patient that is allowed in Europe, and she got a response. She's still responsive to treatment, and this is still ongoing. Of course, coming back to your question, what if she will progress? For sure, I will consider sacituzumab govitecan in that case.
Hope, what do we know about patients who progress on TDXD and how they respond to SG and vice versa, hormone positive, hormone negative?
There's a number of retrospective data sets looking at this from UCSF. Laura Hubbard did also a multi-center retrospective study with a number of our colleagues. But there are many others, Dana-Farber, a French study, et cetera. And all of them showed essentially the first ADC works better than the second in general, but not in all patients. And I've had the experience where the second ADC worked longer than the first with both variations, either TDXD or SG. So I think what we know now is that there is some efficacy of sequencing ADCs, even though the payloads all are topoisomerase inhibitors. Potentially the antibodies make a difference. And I think there's also been a suggestion that just in case you downregulate the receptor, would you, get a treatment in between? You know, this is all hypothetical. So there are a number of studies looking at this, the series study looking at SG after TDXT. Laura Hubbard has a prospective study within our consortium. And then there's a large study called Trade DXT out of Dana-Farber through our consortium that's looking at Dato-DXT, the other TROP2 ADC, with TDXD in, switching either one first or the other one first in both HR-positive and HR-negative disease. So I think this, with a lot of correlative studies, is going to really help us a lot in understanding sequencing and mechanisms of resistance, we hope.
You know, here we talk about ADCs, it seems like in every solid tumor, and people always are getting into the question of, do you want to switch the payload? Do you want to switch the target? Yeah. And it seems that that's still a question of debate. And Antonio, your case scenario brings up another really interesting question. Actually, this comes up in lung cancer all the time, where TDXD is used usually first line for metastatic disease, with HER2 mutant disease, which is more common in non-small cell lung cancer. But this is very similar to Giuseppe's case, triple negative or ER negative with HER2 low. But this patient has tumor in her lung, and they're symptomatic from it. The patient has a cough, and the cough gets better, and she has, I guess, a partial response on capecitabine. But then the question is, what comes next? And this brings up another of Michael's questions, which, again, comes up with lung all the time, which is, what do you do with somebody who has pre-existing tumor in the lung? What do you do with somebody who has pre-existing non-cancer disease in the lung, COPD, cardiovascular disease all the time, and lung cancer, and a situation with your patient who had, tumor-related symptoms? Any thoughts about how you kind of think through this scenario, Antonio?
Yeah, so I think the biggest challenge here is what the patient is minimally symptomatic. The patient had some benefit on first line, in this case, capecitabine, now has evidence of disease progression. Is this patient potentially, because has some underlying, not lung disease or complications from therapy, but symptoms from the disease, is this patient going to be at a greater risk of developing pulmonary toxicity or complications with a drug such as trastuzumab deruxtecan? So I think when I see a patient like this, I do speak with them. I think you can go any of these three options. I don't think that there is one correct option to go with. I tend to think, at the end of the day, ADC is another chemotherapy drug. The conversation minutes ago is, what we really lack are biomarkers predictive of response. And we don't have them for TDXD. We don't have them for sacituzumab govitecan. All of these drugs will have toxicities. I can tell you what I have done for many patients, especially older patients. On purpose, I have started lower doses of the ADC, 7.5 milligrams of SASE, or a little bit less TDXD. And guess what? I see responses, which goes back to the point we go with maximum tolerated dose, but we really do not know what the minimal effective dose is.
Yeah, we had a couple of patients present here last year with, I think, 88, 90-year-old women with a bad chest wall disease, and the doc, you know, gave a lower dose of TDXD. The patients, both of them, responded. Giuseppe, getting back to this issue of prior lung disease, Michael brings up an interesting point. Previous history of COVID, is that, how does that enter your mind, assuming they've completely recovered or maybe they haven't completely recovered, long COVID, et cetera? I know Hope's dying to answer, but let me have you give your answer first, Giuseppe.
No, a previous COVID infection is not a contraindication to give trastuzumab deruxtecan. We have to consider eventually for some patients who got everolimus ILD, because I had personally some patients with ILD induced by everolimus, then treated with TDX, and ILD reappeared. But just to be very pragmatic, we can retreat patients with asymptomatic ILD. You can rechallenge. You may have eventually a new ILD. You have just to stop in case of grade 2. In this case, COVID was not a contraindication.
Yeah, we actually have a case later on of somebody who had everolimus pneumonitis. Now we get to Hope's question. As usual, all Hope's cases are complicated, but I want to cut to the chase. This starts in, this is like a novel. It starts in 2008 with, you know, a lot of interesting developments along the way in this patient. But what I really want to focus on is this point. This patient gets to a point where you're thinking about TDXD. One of the things that caught my attention was because of, I guess, retroperitoneal adenopathy, she had nephrostomy stents in there. I was curious what you did in terms of GSF prophylaxis or concerns about infection. Maybe you could just sort of summarize how the patient got to this point and what happened.
So this was a really complicated young woman. I mean, I started treating her at 37. She's now 50. I was kind of surprised when I looked her up. It's like, we've had a long time. But she had just, you know, refractory nausea and vomiting, and then this, you know, the hydronephrosis requiring not just stents, but like what we hate as oncologists, nephrostomy tubes. So she's this, you know, active woman who's got these bags coming out of her side and couldn't keep anything down, was losing weight. So couldn't actually see her cancer well, but her markers were going up. So we switched her to TDXT. So the big question there was, you know, if you look at the pooled analysis published in ESMO Open a couple of years ago, the risk factors for TDXD included patients who had renal insufficiency. So if you have a higher renal, you know, bad kidney function. Her kidney function was pretty good, but for that, we monitored her very closely. And she did have one, you know, she started in November, and she only had gram glass opacities in April of this year. So we held one cycle, gave her a little steroids, went away, and she's continuing now. And so this is the longest time she's been on any therapy. And what was really amazing in this patient is that everything went away. I mean, she was able to eat for the first time since, you know, 2 years. And her hydronephrosis went away. Her nephrostomy tubes came out. I mean, it's really, and you can see her tumor markers there, which are just starting to go up now. We're very sad to see that. But it's really quite remarkable. So I do think that just having, you know, any respiratory issues, I completely agree with Giuseppe, is not really the issue for us. But renal insufficiency, being older, having a prior ILD, and what's really important is that prior pneumonitis was an exclusion for all of the trials. So the only data we have is anecdotal, and we both have patients who developed ILD after having pneumonitis treated and cured from everolimus. And that my one patient who developed pneumonitis within 10 days of her first dose of TDXD, so symptomatic, couldn't go back on, I gave her TDM1 because she has a somatic mutation. I know it's off-label. And within 2 days, she was hospitalized with hypoxia, so that was not a good idea. So it does appear that, and that's a rare thing, right? So it does appear that once you get that lung thing, you're at risk, and we have to be really careful with those patients.
So, and I see she's starting to get GI symptoms, and you're
just a little. She threw
a little
up
concerned
once.
About her. And Michael wants to know: do you ever continue TDXD in the face of progression, a la, you know, trastuzumab in the past? And also, getting back to my question about cytopenias with TDXD and how you deal
with
them.
Sorry, I didn't answer that. So, you know, cytopenias with TDXD are quite uncommon. The patients I've seen with cytopenias have already struggled with other treatments, so you already know to look out for them in advance. I've treated patients with dose-reduced TDXD that had, you know, really terrible thrombocytopenia from marrow infiltration, and you can get them through dose-reduced TDXD. In the patients who have neutropenia, it's a strange thing. I've generally found a single dose of growth factor on day 3 or 4 is enough, which doesn't make sense. So I haven't needed a lot. I think my whole treatments with TDXD, I've given one patient pegfilgrastim. So not a lot of growth factor need. They generally maintain their counts, do really well. There doesn't seem to be cumulative effects either, which is great. And we do retreat again for the asymptomatic ILD once that you've had mostly resolution on radiographic findings. So we don't have much of a problem there. The biggest issue with TDXD is nausea. And so we manage that quite aggressively with a triple drug preventive regimen. And then we use a lot of olanzapine as for this long delayed nausea that can be observed. And it's extremely effective.
And Giuseppe's going to get into that in his talk. But Aditya, getting back also to this patient right now, I don't think I see an ADC or chemotherapy up to now. So I guess another question would be what might be coming next. And also getting back to Michael's question, any situations, maybe he says a patient has responded with CNS disease where you'd keep TDXD going on progression?
Yeah, in terms of if this patient has disease progression on TDXD, I would consider SG as the next line, because we know there's a subgroup where there might be cross resistance, but we don't have a biomarker to predict what that subgroup is or which patient would not derive benefit from ADC after ADC. So in clinical practice, we would use it. If this patient has control of disease elsewhere, just a couple of spots in the brain, then I would consider SRS or local treatment and then continue the same treatment.
Good point. Okay, we're going to move on. We already started talking about tolerability issues with TDXD. There's so much to talk about, and we're going to let Giuseppe review some of the data and talk about it a little bit more. So, Giuseppe?
Yes, thank you. So we'll try to provide an overview on the most important toxicity induced by trastuzumab deruxtecan and some suggestions based, of course, on the clinical trial and on some specific guidelines. So if we check the incidence of toxicity related to antibody drug conjugated, the rate of any grade treatment-related adverse events is more than 90%. With all the ADC approved. So this is finally a smart chemotherapy, so we have to be careful also in managing it. When evaluating drug-related treatment-emergent adverse events in more than 20%, these are the data of DESTINY-6, so patients never pretreated with chemotherapy, you will see we have 65% of patients with nausea, fatigue, that is really an issue, 46%, alopecia, neutropenia, transaminase increase, anemia, vomiting, and diarrhea. So you can see the spectrum of toxicity is from the hematological toxicity to the gastrointestinal toxicity. So how to manage it? This is a little bit an exercise, but this is a very nice figure. I suggest to you to read this paper on ESMO Open. Professor Ruge is the first author, but it's very practical. So if you have nausea and vomiting, the suggestion is to use the triplet combination and to use olanzapine. This is very common, nausea and vomiting. So if you start preventive treatment like this, of course, compliance will be higher and you will not address many other problems. So the suggestion is to use a premedication like a highly emetogenic treatment, exactly like platinum salts of anthracycline. What's about the data? In Destiny Breast 03, 72% of the patients and 44% experienced the grade 3 or more nausea and vomiting. And also in the Destiny Breast 01, we had exactly the same incidence of nausea and vomiting. So pre-treatment with a 5-HT3 receptor antagonist, dexamethasone, with or without neurokinin 1 receptor antagonist, is really the suggested pre-medication. Delayed nausea prophylaxis, dexamethasone is suggested. And of course, if resolved in less than 7 days, maintain the dose. If there is more than 7 days, you need to reduce by one dose level. So this is the management protocol you will see, and what to do before infusion day one, after infusion day one, and on day 2 to 4. This table is clearly reported in this paper on ESMO Open. If we move to neutropenia, of course, neutropenia is a common side effect of many ADC. The incidence in DESTINY-Breast03 was 42%. Of course, in case of grade 3, you should hold the trastuzumab deruxtecan until resolved to grade less than 2, and then you maintain the same dose. If you have a grade 4, hold TDX until resolved to grade less than 2, and then reduce by one dose level. Febrile neutropenia is quite uncommon with trastuzumab deruxtecan, more common with sacituzumab govitecan, but not with TDX. If you have a febrile neutropenia, hold TDX until resolved and then reduce by one dose level. Thrombocytopenia is not so common with TDX, is more common with T-DM1 as an example. For grade 3, hold TDX until resolved to grade 1 and then reduce or maintain the dose. For grade 4, you need a dose reduction. Cardiac toxicity. It's not an issue with trastuzumab deruxtecan. I never observed any symptomatic cardiac toxicity. The incidence in all the clinical trial is very low, less than 1%. In the majority of the cases, asymptomatic reduction of left ventricular ejection fraction. If we check the data, of course, on ejection fraction decrease, you will see that in the DESTINY-6, there is no grade 4. And there were only 0.7% grade 3. Of course, much more common is ILD. In the DESTINY-6, incidence of ILD was 11%. What is really important is to screen, and of course to be very careful to symptoms, even if the majority of ILD are asymptomatic, as you know, to scan. Suggestion is exactly to perform a CT scan every 6-12 weeks. This is really important. In the clinical trial, of course, it's more easy because we reevaluate the disease. Then once ILD is detected, a multidisciplinary approach is needed. So interact with your pneumologist. TDX should be stopped, and then you should start treatment with steroids. Just to remind to you, the dose of steroids should be appropriate in order to induce a complete resolution, because the majority of ILD grade 1 have a complete resolution, and this means that you can restart treatment. In case of grade 2, is not allowed to restart treatment with trastuzumab deruxtecan, and grade 2 is a symptomatic ILD. So, what's about spatial population? Regarding elderly, you know, I had the opportunity to treat also patients over 80s. This is not a contraindication. In this pooled analysis of DESTINY 1, 2, and 3, finally, you can see that outcome and toxicity in patients less than 65 and more than 65 is very similar, despite, of course, there is more hematological toxicity in the elderly population, more delays and more discontinuation in the pooled analysis. But overall, the median progression-free survival is clearly the same, less than 65 and more than 65. So elderly is not a contraindication to give trastuzumab deruxtecan. And these are the data, of course, of PFS in HR-positive HER2-low by age in the metastatic breast cancer is very similar in more than 65 and less than 65. Data on brain mets are very limited for HER2-low population. So we have some data from the DESTINY-4, and we have the DEBRA trial, that is a small trial of an academic group that is testing, you will see in cohort 5, 7 patients with their too low disease. So if in their too positive disease is very clear the benefit, you have response rate close to 60% in HER2 positive disease. In HER2 low, we don't have sufficient level of evidence to delay the use of radiation therapy. There are some data, anecdotal data of activity, but we don't have clear evidence that we can delay radiation therapy. So even if you have asymptomatic brain mets, you should perform radiation therapy first. So, in conclusion, advances in the ADC field have led to meaningful prognostic improvement across cancer types. Despite being more active in respect to chemotherapy, the current generation of ADC are more toxic, of course, than chemotherapy sometimes, with higher incidence of most chemotherapy-related side effects. We need to optimize the toxicity of ADC, and maybe the optimization should be done better in the phase 1 studies. We just mentioned that sometimes we start with the lower dose, even if the advice is to start with the standard dose. And so we have some data on pharmacogenomics, at least for sacituzumab govitecan, presented by Professor Rugo and published. You know that the CYP1A1 polymorphism 2828 seems to predict more toxicity of topoisomerase 1 inhibitor. We don't have similar data in trastuzumab deruxtecan, but I believe that in the future, patient-reported outcomes with wearable device and more data of pharmacogenomics may help us to better optimize treatment with ADC. Thank you.
Thanks, Giuseppe. And we have a couple more cases, but also from the audience at DTX, several people asked a question, including Michael, but also Martha from the chat room. Hey, Martha. She says, Aditya, I have a number of patients with metastatic HER2-low breast cancer who have had excellent results on TDXD. Some have asked if they could take TDXD at a longer interval, like every 4 weeks, to have less side effects. Any thoughts?
No, it's an interesting concept. If the patient is
Hope says yes.
I guess we have the answer now. So the short answer is yes. It's better to keep the patient on the drug than to completely discontinue it.
Hope, you want to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, I've had some older patients who just did incredibly well, you know, great responses, but they could not get the drug every 3 weeks. You know, they can't get out of bed. So one of them, they keep negotiating with you. You know, I'm having a good response. So, you know, I'd like to get it every 4 weeks. And then they go, you know, every 6 weeks, I start to get a little uncomfortable. But, you know, these are patients who are, you know, quite elderly, like late 70s, early 80s. And, you know, keeping them on drug and having their disease controlled, it seems worth it, you know. We dose reduce, and I think we can probably give the drug less frequently in these unique situations.
The art of oncology. So, Antonio, here's a variation of the case you presented, but another board-type case here. Yes. This is the everolimus case that I was thinking about. So this is a patient with ER-positive HER2 IHC1+, so HER2-low, who ends up getting everolimus and exemestane. After 6 months on this combination, she gets a dry cough, diffuse pulmonary infiltrates. You stop the everolimus, the cough and infiltrates resolve within 30 days, but then she has disease progression. How do you think through what's next? And particularly, how do you think about TDXD in a case like this?
Yeah, so this is a patient who had first line, had adjuvant therapy with ovarian suppression, tamoxifen, and now has recurrence 2 years later, first line letrozole, palbo, has a nice response for about 30 months or so, then has disease progression, goes on second line, exemestane, everolimus. There were no markers, no targeted therapy that we could use, and then develop some pulmonary toxicity to everolimus, but responds on its own after stopping drug and becomes asymptomatic, but soon has disease progression. So 30 months, first-line endocrine therapy, 8 months into progression-free survival in the second-line setting, and now has disease progression. And what do you do? And you see three options there. I actually think, again, you can go any of those options. This actually is a patient that could potentially be considered for a DB06. So nobody would criticize you if you were to give this patient first-line chemotherapy using trastuzumab deruxtecan. But also, this is a patient who has minimal issues in terms of disease progression. In the discussion that Ian Kropp gave at ASCO after Giuseppe gave his presentation, the question becomes, should this patient get TDXD now versus TDXD later? So I think this is a patient that should get at some point TDXD, but I see no reason why not proceed with potentially first-line capecitabine, or in fact, I don't think it's a bad idea, double negative, to potentially try another round of endocrine therapy with another CDK4/6 inhibitor, because this patient had the 30-month PFS with first line. So I think we have many options. And I would just add to the previous conversation about changing the schedule, simplifying things a little bit. Patients have toxicities. Can you go the tolerability? They want to go with 4 weeks instead of 3 weeks. I think we learned a long time ago. This is 1993, high MUS, maintenance chemotherapy versus a break after induction chemotherapy. Maintenance therapy is associated with longer PFS. So what I tell my patients is the difference between running 100 yards versus jogging a mile versus walking 10 miles. We're going the long distance here. It's a matter of reducing and adjusting the pace. So I reduce the dose. I change the schedule quite often to allow patients to stay on therapy.
So I was just I know this patient's ESR1 negative. I was just flashing on, we haven't seen Ember-3 yet with imlunestrant, right? But that's coming up. So hopefully talk about that tomorrow. So that'd be maybe another thing to add if the patient was ESR1 positive. So we're getting into another of Hope's case and another question of a patient with a pulmonary issue. But just sort of getting back to, oncology 101, I guess, nowadays, Aditya. And this is interesting when you start asking the lung and the GI and the biliary and everybody else this question. You guys, I always get the same answer, but them, not so much, which is how often do you need to do chest imaging in a patient on TDXD, assuming they don't need it, for tumor evaluation? And what does it take for you to discontinue TDXD?
Yeah, so standard guidelines would say 6 to 12 weeks. Sometimes we do run into insurance issues. So I'm closer to 12 weeks as opposed to 6 weeks in this scenario. And if a patient is really doing well, you can even space that out after a year. In terms of, your question about TDXD toxicity management, pneumonitis, that's the main concern. If a patient is asymptomatic, we would hold TDXD. But what if a patient just has mild symptoms, cough or shortness of breath? Per guidelines, TDXD should be discontinued completely. But clinically, we feel if a patient is running out of options, that's a scenario you could consider continuing TDXD, but with very close monitoring.
So I hope you have another kind of complicated case, but the thing that I think is interesting in this patient who was actually on DESTINY-Breast04 is it looks like she was responding, but then she gets a non-occlusive pulmonary embolus and has associated focal GGOs, and you've got some images. So maybe we can focus on that aspect and how you think that through.
Yeah, I think it's really tough. I mean, I will say that for patients who had the patient of Antonio's who had prior everolimus ILD, I just want to caution everybody that this is a risk factor and you probably should get a CT at 6 weeks just to check. In that patient, you have a really high risk patient, high risk factors. In this patient, she was on, she had a great response, and then had this pulmonary embolism and had focal ground glass opacity. She had such a nice response. Kind of like what Aditya was talking about, you don't really think it's drug-induced ILD. So we gave her steroids and held. Her symptoms resolved. Everything cleared up and restarted. And she actually stayed on for a long time after that. She kept having intermittent ground glass opacities, but she also had asthma. She got COVID. It was all these complications. And then in February of 22, she actually had symptomatic shortness of breath with ground glass opacities. I could not explained by another reason, and I had to permanently discontinue her. I will say the adjudication committee of DB04 thought she had grade 2 ILD a lot earlier than I did, but she still did okay. I think there's some, individual risk factor that means you're going to die from your ILD versus those who don't.
She got COVID on TDXD?
Yeah.
How did that go?
She was fine. I mean, I held the drug, gave her some steroids. She got better. She took Paxlovid, I think.
How sick was she from the COVID?
She was a little short of breath with coughing and had fevers, I think, for 2 days. It wasn't too bad. And it was 22, so I think actually 21. So it was early in the whole COVID world.
Right. That seems like a long time.
But she survived that, and she's still on treatment now. So she actually, when I stopped it, you know, she said, well, I don't really need any treatment. I don't have any disease right now. It's like, okay. So we watched her, I think, from February till August when she restarted the next treatment. And I think others have seen that, too, where you can get really a long duration of disease control.
Giuseppe, we did a great presentation of some of your work on management of GI toxicity. Anything you want to say about what happened with her? No, I mean, Hope, what happened with this lady?
Is that... Oh. So,
gave her CBD gummies, I see.
Yeah, so the biggest issue for her was not that she was never worried about the interstitial lung disease because she had asthma, right? So she had other symptoms all along. But what she was worried about was her nausea. And she was one of these patients who have this sort of newer defined category of long delayed nausea where you're still nauseated 10 days after you got the treatment. And again, in this patient, olanzapine was a real savior for managing the drug, and we dose reduced as well. And that helped. I mean, she's somebody who gets nauseated with most treatments. So olanzapine's been very helpful for her. But it just shows you, you know, some of the ILD here, you know, both before and after getting steroids and how much steroids really helped her over time. And it's remarkable. You know, you do wonder if you see a little bit of a change in these HR-positive patients who are responding to treatment. I mean, she just started gemcitabine and carboplatin, and so it's way down the line in her treatment. And she's had SBRT to brain lesions two times, I think, now.
And I see she's on gem carbo right now.
She just started.
Giuseppe, anything you want to say about this case?
But you know, for sure, it's very important to routinely recommend GI prophylaxis for nausea and vomiting. So what I do is to use every time the triplet combination, and olanzapine is still there is persistent nausea and vomiting. It's really important because the quality of life for patients receiving TDX is affected by nausea and vomiting and by fatigue. Yeah. Because ILD in the majority of the cases is asymptomatic. And so these are the problems that should be addressed in order to increase compliance and adherence to treatment. And as Aditya said, I prefer to delay by 1 week rather than stop treatment. It's very reasonable.
Any experience with CBD gummies or THC preparations, Giuseppe?
No preference specifically, but in the majority of the case, neurokinin 1 antagonist I had, really, yes.
All right, so Hope, take us home here with a lot of really cool stuff coming up for now and the future.
Yeah, it is actually a really exciting time. And, you know, we get CBD gummies. We've had them for years. I live in California. So we're going to talk
about... Aditya's used to that now that he's transferred.
Now he's there, too.
Now he got stolen.
So, we're more in Northern California, though. I'm going to talk about future directions. When I saw this, you know, you would get a category list of what we're going to talk about. I was like, oh, no. How am I going to talk about these things that don't have data? And then I found all this data. So there you go. Neil is smarter than all of us always. So we're going to talk about where we're going and moving forward past some of the trials we already talked about in the metastatic setting. There's tons of things going on with ADCs, about moving to early stage and new agents, little data with early stage HER2 low disease with TDXD and combination therapy with TDXD, where lots of studies are going on, new antibody drug conjugates for HER2 low breast cancer. I'm just going to touch the surface, and HER2 targeted bispecific antibodies, a really cool new area as well. So this is the TALENT trial, actually, that Aditya is also involved in, that looked at patients with hormone receptor positive HER2 low disease, stage 2 to 3, and pre or post menopausal women and men. And then there were two arms, so TDXD alone, treatment for 6 cycles, and then they extended it to 8 cycles during the treatment. And then TDXD with anastrozole, and of course ovarian function suppression is needed in tissue acquisition. So this was presented, as you can see, in ASCO of 2022, and I think will be updated relatively soon. At this time, there were a lot of patients that hadn't yet gone to surgery, less than 50% in both arms, and they looked at the RCB 0 and 1 rate, which is about 15%, but you can see here the clinical response in the number of patients, 25 with TDXD, 24 with TDXD and anastrozole. And it looked like very nice responses, but very early data. Certainly no issues in terms of toxicity combining with hormone therapy. One case of grade 2 pneumonitis and only 5% dose reductions due to adverse events. So quite nice responses.
Can I just ask you one thing about that previous slide? You mentioned
Can you go
that
backwards?
The IHC decreased in these patients. What do you see in the is that seen in the metastatic setting? Is that seen with other anti-HER therapies?
Yeah, we don't take out the tumor in the metastatic setting, so we haven't really looked at that. There's certainly been some data looking at blood and HER2 IHC expression in circulating tumor cells, but the decreased HER2 IHC at surgery was really interesting, and it hasn't been shown in a lot of trials, although if you looked at the Catherine trial, looking at TDM1 versus TDXD in HER2-positive disease, there were a lot of patients who had very little HER2 expression at the time of surgery. Those patients responded equally well to TDM1 versus continuing trastuzumab and pertuzumab, the Catherine trial, not TDXD. And I think the idea was that this might be a transient reduction in the face of treatment and that you recover the HER2 over time, since certainly even if you had low HER2, you still had a benefit from getting TDM1 versus HP.
Antonio, any comments?
I actually want to mention something important. I encourage all of you who are here to attend a session on Thursday by David Rem, and Kim Allison from Stanford is going to be talking about HER2 IHC issues. What happens also when we see a change from IHC 1 plus in the primary tumor adjuvant setting to IHC 0 in metastasis, this could be purely an artifact, because there is a lot more care now since ASCO CAP on time to ischemia in getting the tissue after a core biopsy, after surgery, very quickly to the pathologist. So there's a chance that this, the IHC 0 in the metastatic tumor, could be simply timed to ischemia, be too long, and this is a fixation artifact at the end of the day.
What about in bone?
Bone is more complicated, because I think also the issues of decalcification of bone tissue can make a tumor IHC 0. I think, as we said before, it's almost as if we should, I mean, Michael Press will tell you his biggest mistake in life was to have created IHC 012, because this is an assay that was developed for the high end, and it does not have dynamic range for lower levels. And so this gets, it's, we ultimately are making potentially too much noise out of an assay that is not potentially fit for purpose.
Okay, Hope.
And I will say that, you know, if you're really IHC 3 plus HER2, you tend to be IHC 3 plus on all of the tests and at surgery in most patients. It's the patients who are 2 plus FISH amplified, we lose IHC more, and again, maybe due to a number of different issues, but they still respond to HER2-targeted therapy. So there's this very interesting study by Wolfgang Jani's group. This is a trials in progress called the SURVIVE study, and SURVIVE Heroes looks at patients who develop ctDNA and then are randomized to get TDXD. And I think it's a really fascinating study, which is currently accruing, so I just thought I would give you that. They're treating for 12 months, and then the standard treatment is just whatever you would normally give that patient.
I'm a big fan of cool trial names. I like that one a lot.
Survive Heroes is really good, yes. And there's a lot of preclinical data suggesting that ADCs and immunotherapy would have some synergy, that the ADC would actually stimulate the host immune response and make the immunotherapy more active, change the tumor microenvironment. And we have a number of combinations, but since we're talking about TDXD, I put TDXD and durvalumab here in the Begonia trial, looking at HER2-low metastatic triple-negative breast cancer and showing a really remarkable response rate, very nice, at 57% in these patients and a long progression-free survival of 12 and a half months. So quite nice. The problem with this was the ILD, that you can't really separate the ILD from durvalumab from T-DXd. Yeah. And so what's been pursued is using TROP2 ADCs in this setting in combination with immunotherapy. But it is quite intriguing that these combinations are being studied and may show new efficacy areas. There's also interest in combining T-DXd with other agents. We saw presented at San Antonio last year T-DXd and anastrozole and fulvestrant in the blue colors there by Komal Javeri. And this year, in a poster on Friday, we'll see the data of T-DXd with capecitabine and capivasertib. These are small treatment arms. You can see just a few patients in each of the arms, 21 and 20 in the combination arms that were presented. Here are the response rates and the overall response. The toxicity was very minimal. The progression-free survival was quite nice, but it's difficult to really understand what the addition of the endocrine therapy is to T-DXd here because we've seen such nice responses with T-DXd. In the abstract, with the capivasertib and the capecitabine, kind of similar data, nice responses as you would expect from T-DXd. Hard to know what the contribution is from the capecitabine or the capivasertib, except for there seemed to be a little bit more ILD in the capi-T-DXd combination arm, and so that's certainly something we would need to watch out for. They saw a number of grade 2 ILDs, I think 8 cases over the total. So no additive safety issues, data set small, but very interesting to consider these combinations as we move forward. When we're thinking about new drugs for HER2-positive breast cancer and expanding to HER2-low, we have a number of new antibody-drug conjugates that are looking in the HER2-low setting. So here I made a table of two agents that are in phase 3 trials and another agent which is in earlier phase trials. And this is by no means exhaustive, but these are the agents that are being tested in HER2-low. So disitamab vedotin has an antibody called hertuzumab, similar to trastuzumab, with a cleavable linker, and MMAE, that's an auristatin, microtubule inhibitor as the payload. And DB1303 has a trastuzumab biosimilar, cleavable linker, and then topoisomerase, a novel topoisomerase 1 inhibitor as the payload. ARX788, again, trastuzumab biosimilar, and has an MMAF analog, doesn't cause the neuropathy, but causes keratitis, a difficult toxicity to manage, and is in phase 2 trials now, and will start in a phase 2 trial in HER2-low, and I won't talk about that one more. There are many other ADCs in early phase trials in HER2-low disease, for example, BB1701, which is an eribulin ADC with a drug-to-antibody ratio of 4. You can see I've listed that there, and there's quite variation. And a phase 1b2 trial is ongoing. A trials in progress is being presented here. So let's just talk a little bit about the data. DB1303 has shown encouraging anti-tumor activity in HER2-low disease and a bunch of tumors, you know, advanced solid tumors. But in patients who had HER2-low breast cancer, you can see the overall response rate in a very heavily pretreated group of patients, only 13, was 38.5%, and it was quite durable, and the toxicity is also quite manageable with some nausea as the primary toxicity, and not a lot of bone marrow suppression, a little bit more than we see with T-DXd, but otherwise not a lot of bone marrow suppression, which is encouraging, and very low rate of possible ILD in this group of patients. And of course, they have other data in other tumor sets. In disitamab vedotin, also promising anti-tumor activity. These are in both studies done in China in patients who had HER2-positive or HER2-low disease. And you can see the data here with all mostly partial responses, no complete responses, a lot of stable disease. The toxicity is more hepatic toxicity with this drug, where they see a grade 1-2 primarily increase in liver enzymes, and about 50% of patients had a decrease in neutrophils with this as well. There is this funny thing called hypoesthesia there, which I think means neuropathy because vedotin causes neuropathy. So we'll have to see what this drug is supposed to cause less than many other vedotin ADCs. So we'll have to see what's shown when we get to additional trials. But there's quite a large pool of patients treated with both of these ADCs now with different cancers. So DV004 is looking at disitamab vedotin plus tucatinib in patients who are HER2-positive and HER2-low after T-DXd, and this shows you the dose-finding escalation and optimization and expansion phases. So this trial is ongoing. And then these are the phase 3 trials with these drugs. Dynasty Breast 02 is the trial with DB1303 compared to treatment of physician choice. It's HR positive, HER2 low, a very similar design that we've seen before. And then RC48 is a trial, as well as ROSIE, both being conducted in China, looking at patients with HER2 low breast cancer who are being treated with disitamab vedotin versus TPC or versus endocrine therapy of physician choice with no targeted agent. Probably a trial very difficult to do here in the U.S., the ROSIE trial, but the RC48 trial I think will be quite interesting, and these patients will have received 1 to 2 lines of prior chemotherapy for advanced disease, whereas the Dynasty Breast 02 is in the first line setting. So ARX788, I mentioned, is being studied in HER2 positive disease in a phase 2 trial, which I won't show you data from, but this is the trial that's starting soon, run by Laura Hubbard out of UCSF, looking at ARX788 and HER2 low metastatic disease. And one of the fascinating areas of this study is a collaboration with our ophthalmologist, our research ophthalmologist at UCSF, where we're looking at a number of different ways to try and counteract the keratitis, where you get these microvesicles that move from the periphery of your eye in front of the pupil and then cause a lot of visual disturbance, pain, tearing, et cetera. So by using specific different drops, we're hoping to prevent the eye toxicity. So that will also be a component of this trial. So we're looking at T-DXd in combination with a novel immunotherapy agent in I-SPY 2.2, our adaptively randomized phase 2 neoadjuvant trial in Block A, shown here, very complicated trial. These patients have stage 2 and 3 disease, mammoprint high risk, and are HER2 negative, and they receive a bispecific antibody that targets PD-1 and TIGIT called rivagostimig. It takes a long time to say that name. That is being given with T-DXd every 3 weeks for 4 doses. And we've seen some nice responses. It was on hold for a safety evaluation to look at ILD and other toxicities, but we're hoping we'll reopen shortly because that's how we do. I-SPY is to look at toxicity and very careful along the way. So another way of looking at T-DXd in patients with HER2-low disease as well as HER2-zero disease. So what about novel HER2 antibodies? So we have 2 bispecific antibodies, zenocutuzumab and zanidatamab, that were most recently US FDA approved for non-breast cancer indications. So zenocutuzumab is a bispecific antibody to HER2 and HER3, and zanidatamab is a biparatopic antibody that binds to 2 extracellular domains on HER2. And they had an ADC that was in early phase trials but has been discontinued. So here's zenocutuzumab, a fascinating novel bispecific antibody, and it targets neuregulin-positive cancers. So how many people here have been thinking about neuregulin until the last few weeks? Not too many. Certainly we haven't. But neuregulin, NRG1, is a ligand that binds to HER3, and it promotes HER2, HER3 heterodimerization, and that leads to cancer growth, which is really fascinating. So if you target NRG, that seems to be a very effective treatment. These NRG1 fusions are associated with a poor prognosis and also lower response to standard therapy and shorter overall survival in a number of cancers, including non-small cell lung cancer and other cancers as well. Zenocutuzumab also, because of this binding, results in antibody-dependent cellular cytotoxicity, so it has an immune effect as well. On December 4th, very recently, there was accelerated approval for patients with advanced small cell lung cancer or pancreatic cancer, progressing on prior therapy who have a neuregulin 1 gene fusion. And I've just shown you here the responses, which are fairly amazing. The overall response was 33%, median duration of response 7.4 months for lung cancer, and from pancreatic cancer, 40%, with a range of duration of response not yet reached, but 3.7 to 16.6 months for adenocarcinoma of the pancreas. All of these patients have NRG1 fusion genes, so important. And then you can see the toxicities listed here that I won't go through in great detail, just to say you can get some diarrhea and nausea, but overall it's well tolerated. So neuregulin promotes cellular growth. This is wild type, just to explain it. There's neuregulin on the right-hand side for you. And then if you block it, it's really interesting. So the signaling domain is tethered to the membrane. So what fusion are you looking for? There are many different fusions that are part of NRG G1 fusion. So you can see a number of different fusions, all of which impact this outcome. And we've, so far, the data suggests it's fairly rare in breast cancer, up to about 5% with these multiple fusion partners. So NRG1 solid tumors, very nice responses you can see here, including some breast cancer patients, a small number. So what about the zanidatamab? So this is a very interesting bioparatopic antibody targeting HER2, as you can see, and it's this dual binding drives its unique mechanism of action, and it basically binds to anti-HER2 extracellular domain 4 and extracellular domain 2, and that results in unique activity. The domains targeted by trastuzumab and pertuzumab. So this drug also was FDA approved on November 20th based on the data in previously treated biliary tract cancer, HER2 positive. This is a very difficult cancer to treat. So all they have to do is be IHC 3+, and this drug worked very well with a response rate of 52% and a median duration of response of almost 15 months. And it's a well-tolerated drug. So zanidatamab is effective as monotherapy in many advanced tumors across HER2-expressing tumor types, and you can see here a number of different trials. GE junction is GE there. And after progression on other HER2 therapies also, you can see very nice waterfall plots here, all the HER2 therapies listed there. And is neoadjuvant for HER2-positive breast cancer studied at MD Anderson and presented last year at this meeting. There were nice responses, even though patients only got 3 cycles of neoadjuvant zanidatamab, so 6 to 10 doses, and showed significant efficacy and was very well tolerated. And you can see how nicely the disease is controlled. So zanidatamab and evorpacept and HER2-positive and HER2-low data will be presented here. The evorpacept data will be presented at a later time. That's a CD47 inhibitor. Two core cohorts are being presented, HER2-positive with progressive disease after T-DXd and HER2-low with progressive disease after T-DXd. And just to focus on that group of patients, 15 patients, median of 5 lines of prior therapy with an overall response of 20% and a duration of response of 6 months, which is quite nice. PFS will be reported on the poster here at this meeting, and overall it's well-tolerated and exciting data. Empower is a phase 3 trial looking at zanidatamab versus trastuzumab in HER2-positive disease, but zanidatamab is also being studied in I-SPY as neoadjuvant therapy for HER2-positive disease as well. So lots of expanded roles in HER2-low disease under evaluation in combinations with a variety of different agents. Novel HER2 ADCs, very exciting. And bispecific antibodies, I think, are also a very exciting new way to target HER2 that may be effective in HER2-low disease.
So I don't know if it's 8:45 or 9:45 or what time it is for people here. I've never seen somebody wide eyes, like not blinking in the last 15 minutes. Anyhow, thanks so much for the faculty and coming back here tomorrow night. ER-positive endocrine-based therapy at breast cancer. Have a great night.